Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels at BlakeRadio.com at the Rainbow Soul Channel. And it is April 22nd, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Today's topic is proven ineffective. I know you've heard of ineffective therapies, but this one is proven ineffective, which I found quite shocking. And so basically, the question is your doctor prescribing drugs that are proven to be ineffective and dangerous? So tonight, I'm going to review in detail a blockbuster drug. Now, I don't think you should say, well, this drug is bad. Instead, I think you should say, could it be that all of the drugs have this characteristic? Could this be a more generalized trend, the nose of the camel under the tent? An indication of greater things that are out there. So I'm mentioning this drug more as a typical example as opposed to saying one particular drug is or isn't useful. So the question, of course, one might ask, is if a drug is proven ineffective by the manufacturer's own admission, the manufacturer's own studies, yet the FDA not only approves the drug, but the drug becomes a blockbuster hit. And so tonight I'm going to just review this in detail. And I'm going to tell you the history of how I came to be remotely aware of this, actually aware of this. And it wasn't clear to me at the time what was going on. So as a naive 20-something-year-old person, all I knew was there's a whole lot of suffering going on. And no one seemed to be getting any better. That's really all I knew. It seemed to me the drugs were not effective, but, you know, I finished high school, I graduated from Harvard University, majoring in biology, I'd graduated from an Ivy League medical school, and everything I was taught, so I believed, was based in science. Of course, that means it was found to be true. Somebody else, somebody I could trust, somebody I'd never met, but somehow could trust, had looked into all this on my behalf. And so I didn't, at the age of 20-something, I guess really 22 to 27, I didn't have the determination to flat out say, hey, wait a minute, something's wrong here. So all right, we have a sound crisis here. Let's see what we can do about this. Okay, how's the volume now? All right, we're back up. back on. And I want you to know, don't worry. I have new technology in place. Everything I'm saying is being caught in ultra-high definition sound and can be posted so it can be easily heard. Okay, so at 20-something, I didn't have whatever it takes to really question this, even though my observation was that nothing was really working. And this was in the area of cancer. And finally, at one point, you know, people were inquiring of the cancer specialist, and finally the cancer specialist gave an answer. And the answer was, what we are doing, we know to be ineffective and possibly even harmful, and so we're waiting for new research. Well, now, let's see, that was 1984. It's now 30 years exactly later, and the same drugs are being used for cancer therapy. Now, before we even question any one particular drug, we need to take a look at a statistical fact. I was taught in medical school. So I was taught in medical school that every 4 years, half of all the information that I was taught in medical school was going to be untrue, useless, and ineffective. In other words, it was going to be false. And so I said, wait a minute. Well, what are we going to do? How do we replace this bad news? How do we replace all these lies with the truth? How do we do that? And they said, Dr. Daniels, don't you worry your pretty little head. We've got that base covered. It's called continuing medical education. Okay. So now here we are 30 years later and approximately 7.5 lives later. And so basically less than 1% of everything that was being done in 1984 is still true. So less than 1%. That means that of all the drugs being used in cancer at the time, 1984, only 1%, actually less than 1%, are still of any benefit whatever. Now, I have it on pretty good authority that fewer than 100 different drugs were being used for chemotherapy back then. Fairly small number. So literally zero of those drugs should still be effective at all. However, many of the drugs being used today in chemotherapy are the identical drugs being used 30 years ago. Back when I first started, when I scratched my head and said, I see a lot of suffering, I don't see anyone getting better. I better leave this to the experts who've got, you know, maybe much better tools than I do. And so I trusted that the chemotherapy people and the cancer people were on the case and that they were solving this problem. Okay. So I leave medical school, I turn my back on the whole thing, on the whole cancer industry, leave it all to the experts, decide I'm not going to bother my pretty little brain about this, and here we are, 2014, and people who have cancer are calling me and saying, hey, my doctor says I could take XYZ or ABC drug. And I say to myself, that's interesting. Let's take a look at it. And so what I'm going to take a look at is the big latest news in breast cancer therapy. This is something called Herceptin. I like that name. I'm sure someone earned a lot of money picking that name. It's a very nice name. And trastuzumab is the generic name. But Herceptin is the name, and it's made by a company named Genentech. The interesting thing to note about this drug is that it's been around for a while. It's been around for definitely more than 10 years, but for a while. But the point is, it already has a black box warning, cardiomyopathy. And this starts with this. Package insert, pull it out, and the first thing it says, black box warning, will destroy your heart, and you'll develop ventricular dysfunction and congestive heart failure. And they have a lot of, you know, grandiose terms here, but the bottom line is you'll have difficulty breathing, you'll have chest pain, your ankles will swell up, and you'll be confined to the couch and immobile. And so what you're saying is you should strongly consider stopping this drug in patients who develop a clinically significant decrease in heart function. This is interesting. So if a person has a decrease in heart function, but it's not clinically significant, don't worry about it. So what you're saying is an X-ray or laboratory finding is not relevant when you're judging the harm done by this drug. This is going to become important later on. Don't go by lab results. Wait until the patient is visibly suffering and not doing well and actually clinically harmed, that their life is somehow limited by this bad heart, instead of just stopping the drug. All right, good enough. Now, to understand the next piece about Herceptin, they describe it, is we need to just take a step outside the scientific realm here and get some fresh air of reality. If you're trying to heal from cancer, then you probably have the notion that avoiding genetically modified foods would be helpful to you. You probably think this. I'm not going to question that belief. We'll just leave it and say it does. That avoiding genetically modified foods is helpful. You probably think also that you shouldn't put chemicals in your body that could clog up your system. And so this might not be useful for your cancer. Okay, so let's take a look. What's Herceptin? I'm going to describe this. It's a recombinant DNA-derived humanized monoclonal antibody. Now, there's a lot of you out there who say, Dr. Daniels, I don't have enough education to understand what you just said, so let me put it in English. Herceptin is a genetically modified organism, derivative. In other words, this is a GMO substance that selectively binds with high affinity in a cell-based assay. It's not in the body. It's a cell-based assay. To the extracellular, that means outside the cell, domain of the human epidermal growth factor receptor protein, HER2. Those of you who are into breast cancer stuff, everyone's HER2 is the big deal. And so they've also produced a mammalian cell from the Chinese hamster ovary. Yes, how close can you get to people, Chinese hamster? Nothing against the Chinese, but it is a hamster. And so they also use this ovary from the hamster, and they use a nutrient medium containing an antibiotic called gentamicin, and they promise gentamicin in the final product. This is important because gentamicin causes deafness and a whole lot of other bad things. And this is sterile, preservative-free. That's nice. And the content of each vial is histidine, polysorbate 20, reconstituted with bacteriostatic water, means there's an antibiotic in there somewhere, and benzoyl alcohol as a preservative. And so they're going to dilute this thing to a pH of 6. Many of you, again, we're going to take a dose of reality here, get some fresh air. Many natural healers feel that you need to alkalinize the blood, make it more alkaline to get rid of cancer. Okay, and alkaline is a pH, that's a number, higher than 7.5. And so here, they're going to inject you with a solution that's at a pH of 6, okay? So we have a genetically modified substance with an acidic pH being injected into the bloodstream of a person with cancer, supposedly with the intent of healing this individual. Okay. And now they go on to the general information, clinical pharmacology. And so the overexpression of this HER2 protein is observed in 30% of primary breast cancers. Primary means first. This is a lady's first breast cancer. One third of all these ladies are going to have an overexpression of this protein. And it's going to be determined using an immunohistochemistry-based assessment of fixed tumor blocks. Okay? That means they're going to put a chemical over some tissue, see what reacts, and that's how they're going to tell if there's an overexpression of this HER2 protein. And it's been shown in both in vitro assays and in animals, okay, that means not people, to inhibit the proliferation of tumor cells that overexpress this. So outside of the body and in animals, it's been shown to inhibit the proliferation of tumor cells. And so it's a mediator of cellular cytotoxicity, in other words, it kills cells. And so where you see this protein near or on a cell, that cell can expect it to be murdered or died. And so it's not going to help with cancer cells that do not overexpress HER2. So the question, of course, is do non-cancer cells overexpress HER2? Don't know. Here is the here's the rub. This is shocking. Clinical studies. The safety and effectiveness of Herceptin were studied in a randomized controlled clinical trial in combination with chemotherapy and an open-label single-agent clinical trial. Both trials studied patients with metastatic breast cancer whose tumors overexpressed HER2. In other words, these ladies were the ones, man. These ladies, they're going to benefit. It's there. We know it's going to work. This is the people that we expect to benefit. And so they had a group of just those people. And patients were eligible if they had 2-plus or 3-plus overexpression based on a 0 to 3 scale by immunochemical assessment of tumor tissue performed by a central testing lab. So far, so good. And so a multi-center randomized trial was conducted, 469 patients with metastatic breast cancer, not previously treated with chemotherapy, and they were randomized, and they received weekly doses of Herceptin and on and on and on. And so what they found was compared with patients randomized to chemotherapy alone, patients randomized to Herceptin and chemotherapy experienced a longer median time to disease progression, higher overall response rate, longer median duration of response, and a higher one-year survival rate. Well, wait a minute. We measure cancer in five-year survivals, not only. The treatment effects were observed both in patients who received Herceptin plus another drug and in those who received Herceptin plus Adriamycin Cytoxin. Now, Adriamycin and Cytoxin are drugs that were used 30 years ago. However, the magnitude of the effects was greater in the polyoxidil subgroup. Okay. So what they found was Herceptin was effective in delaying or in creating something called disease-free survival. So I was looking over all these cancer studies and cancer studies and cancer studies and incredible effectiveness in something called disease-free survival. So I said to myself, wow, cancer's come a long way. These cancer guys have done it. They've done it. They have improved the situation. Then I read the fine print. And the fine print is disease-free survival simply refers to a person who is stage one failing to proceed to stage two. So a person's disease stage can stay the same. Their cancer size can increase, but as long as they don't progress to the next stage, they're counted as surviving without disease. That's called disease-free survival. And anyone who's worked with cancer patients can tell you it's very frustrating that there's absolutely no association between shrinkage of the tumor and survival. So people can have a tumor shrink, yet still increase their overall length of life. This is truly shocking. And so what's happened here then is you have a drug where it's been measured to increase the length of time a person survives, that means person's breathing, without progression, enlargement, or spread of the cancer. But we're not looking at basic survival. So it's very very discouraging. So what they're saying about this, of course, warning the heart toxicity, and if you take a patient and treat it with Herceptin alone, this patient, 7% are going to get heart problems. If you treat a person with Herceptin and Pralexatel, which is another chemotherapy agent, 11% are going to have heart problems. But you treat the patient with Pralexatel alone, only 1% will have heart problems. In other words, 10% of the patients will actually have an increased quality of life because their heart's not going to be damaged. And again, cardiac dysfunction, you know, they've already defined it previously as a clinical thing, so they don't want to hear about any x-ray findings. And if you add Herceptin plus cyclophosphamide, the heart damage goes up to 28%. So if you take Herceptin alone, 7% damage, combine it with anything else, you're going to get up to 11% and then 28%. And so you definitely have a tremendous increase harm. And then if you take a look at class 3 to 4 heart damage, which means the person basically is on the couch, the legs are swollen, difficulty breathing, this is not good, then Herceptin alone gives you a 5% damage. Herceptin plus Paxlovid, this drops down to 4, but it's not, may not be statistically significant. Add Herceptin to cyclophosphamide, and yet 20% of ladies with class 3 to class 4 cardiac damage. Absolutely, absolutely shocking. So what they're suggesting is candidates for treatment with Herceptin should undergo baseline cardiac assessment, including history, physical exam, and one or more of the following, EKG, echocardiogram, MUGA scan. And so, of course, there's no data showing which is the most appropriate thing to do. Again, more money now needs to be spent to monitor the inevitable negative effects. And so we can expect with this drug at least anywhere from 6% to 27% of women are going to be harmed by heart damage, and anywhere from 5% to 15% are going to be severely damaged because they took this drug. Of course, the question is, what percent are actually going to live longer? Where do you get a load of that one? So, in addition to this, they're saying that you should have some precautions. Of course, if someone's allergic to this drug or allergic to Chinese hamster ovary cell protein. So how do you encounter Chinese hamster ovary cell protein? I have no clue. Drug interactions, they're saying there's no formal drug interaction studies. But wait, we have a chart up here showing if you take Herceptin with other chemotherapeutic agents, the cardiac damage is multiplied. That's not a drug interaction? Well, I guess they don't think so. Again, this is all the package insert. So it's not a drug interaction. If you mix it with another drug and increase heart damage from 1% to 28%, that's not a drug interaction. And if you're allergic to benzyl alcohol, don't take it because you're giving that in the IV. And of 903 patients who were evaluated, one developed antibodies to it, and it hasn't been tested for its ability to cause cancer, which is nice. It doesn't cause DNA changes, so they say. It does seem to not bother fertility in female monkeys. But if you're a human, then it's pregnancy category B, which means that it could cause problems. Nursing mothers, they only studied nursing monkeys. And so a woman should be advised to discontinue nursing during Herceptin therapy for 6 months after the last dose of Herceptin. And pediatric use, not safe for kids. Okay. So this is really a shocking effect that this drug has. And so let's talk about the quality of life on Herceptin, because they give you information on that, indirect, but information. Oh, by the way, a cardiac failure we mentioned, but you get anemia and leukopenia. So not you lose your white blood cells, which is backbone of the immune system, and you lose a few red blood cells, but don't worry. They're thinking it's reversible, and they don't think you should discontinue therapy with this drug just because of that. Hematologic, that means blood cells. Toxicity, that means poisoning, is infrequent but does happen. And so about 1%, less than 1%. And you can expect a little bit of diarrhea, 25% of people are going to get diarrhea. Infection, increased incidence of infections, mostly upper respiratory infections, catheter infections, and infusion reactions. During the first infusion of Herceptin, a symptom complex, that means that Herceptin clumps together with other proteins, so symptom complex is basically a clot moving through the blood system, a solid mass. And it's consisted of chills, fever, 40% of patients, and the symptoms usually mild to moderate, and, you know, I guess if you're not experiencing them, these are mild to moderate, and you can just take Tylenol, Benadryl, and Herceptin discontinuation was infrequent, and you could get nausea, vomiting, pain at the tumor site, shakes, headaches, dizziness, shortness of breath, low blood pressure, rash, and numbness. And they have a list of what you could, we doctors call these things minor side effects. These are really quality of life issues. And I think the best thing to look at is Herceptin alone side effects versus Herceptin plus other things, or Herceptin, yeah. So Herceptin alone or Adriamycin alone, 47 and 42%, put the two together, 57% are going to get pain. They're going to get pain somewhere. And the interesting thing is chills, Herceptin 32%, Paxlovid alone 4%, abdominal pain about the same, infection 20%, flu-like syndrome 10%, accidents. More people on Herceptin get accidents, but it's only 6%. No big deal. Another agent, 3%. Heart problems, definitely we know we're going to get those, right? 5%, 12% are going to get heart problems. Nausea, 33% get nausea, as opposed to Paxlovid, 9%. And so this drug comes with a pretty high price tag in terms of side effects. The other thing that people talk about is the financial price tag. And what's the financial price tag? It's very interesting. The financial price tag for this therapy, which is a one-year therapy, which is what they recommend, is about $80,000. So for $80,000, you get to increase what's called your disease-free survival. In other words, your disease symptoms are not reduced, but your x-ray findings are either stable, may reduce, or in any case don't increase to move your cancer to the next classification level. And this is shocking that when we're looking at the side effects of Herceptin, heart disease, for example, I say, wait, we can't look at an x-ray finding of heart damage. We have to look at the clinical expression. Is the person's heart actually worse? But when we look at the benefit of Herceptin, we say, wait, we can use the x-ray finding that the cancer is the same, in the same stage from an x-ray point of view, and not look at, is the person having a better quality of life and is the person living longer? This is very interesting. We have this double standard going on, and not only do we have the double standard, but we have, you know, the FDA and everyone standing by saying, oh, we can measure benefits by x-rays. We can't measure damage by x-rays. We can measure damage only in clinical expression. We're not going to demand that the therapy have a clinically better outcome. So let's take a look what the American Cancer Society says about herbs and what they say about Herceptin. This is interesting. So the American Cancer Society says that treatments with herbs, in this case they're referring to Cassie, Nurse Cassie, but it could be referring to really any herbs. And so what they say is benefit from SCIT, it's a mixture of herbs combined to make a tea, got it, There's been no published clinical trials in conventional medical journals showing that either SEACT has helped in the treatment of cancer. Some of the herbs contained in the mixture have shown some anti-cancer effects in laboratory experiments. However, most laboratory studies have found it didn't work against cancer cells. And how is it promoted? Promoters claim SEACT strengthens the immune system, improves well-being, relieves pain, increases appetite, reduces tumor size, and extends survival. Some also claim that it cleanses the blood, promotes cellular repair, restores energy. And it was originally claimed SEACT worked by changing tumors into normal tissue. So proponents claimed the tumor would become larger and harder after a few doses of SEACT. Then would soften, shrink, and discharge, be discharged by the body. And so they're saying, what's the history behind it? And they talk about neuroacid, but what's the evidence? Although there have been many testimonials, there have been no clinical trials testing the effectiveness of SEACT or Florence or T. Now, of course, you know, clinical trials are paid for by large companies. And so there have been many testimonials. And, you know, the drug companies, you know, I think they should show their testimonials. And reviews of medical records, people who have been treated with herbs do not support claims that this product helps people live longer or it relieves their symptoms. Now, the pharmaceutical drug doesn't even make the claim that people are going to live longer or relieve their symptoms. They're just saying, take this and your x-ray will look better. Okay, so some components of SEACT have been tested individually in animal studies, and some of these studies identify substances with anti-tumor properties. However, these results do not mean that either of these formulas helps humans. Okay, yet, as we can see by looking at the package insert, same non-human data has been admitted for pharmaceuticals, but they're saying herbals, that's not okay. Are there possible problems or complications? Well, these products are sold as a dietary supplement, and unlike companies that produce drugs, which must be tested before being sold, so drugs have to be tested before being sold, but they don't have to be proven effective. So the companies that make supplements are not required to prove to the Food and Drug Administration that their supplements are safe or effective. Some such products may not contain the amount of the herb or substance that's on the label. And some may include other substances, contaminants. Now, we know from prior shows and from reading about pharmaceuticals that they have the same issue. And so the FDA does concede serious side effects are uncommon, unlike the drug we just looked at here, Herceptin, which side effects are very common. So serious side effects are uncommon. It may cause headache, nausea, diarrhea, or constipation, vomiting, low blood sugar, liver and kidney damage, allergic rashes are possible. Really serious allergic reactions have been reported. In addition, it may interact with other drugs. Relying on this type of treatment alone and avoiding or delaying conventional medical care for cancer may have serious health consequences. That's may have. And so for more information, from your cancer, American Cancer Society, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so we have here is a double standard. We have this discussion of a herbal product, and it seems that the pharmaceutical product fits many of these criteria. So let's take a look at what Herceptin has been compared to. Herceptin has been compared to what's called AC, which is cyclophosphamide doxorubicin. Now, doxorubicin is known as Red Death. And it's known as Red Death because when the doxorubicin starts flowing, the patients start dying. And literally, when I was a resident, we would shudder when a doctor would recommend doxorubicin. You'd basically leave the floor because you didn't want to even witness the torture. So they've actually done studies. They don't do a whole lot, but every now and then they'll do a study. But in the in PubMed and the journal and the Cancer Journal, they actually did a study: 16 months of chemotherapy, patients taking doxorubicin, 7% of the deaths were caused by the doxorubicin. So 7% would not have died had they not taken doxorubicin. And again, they only counted as side effects heart failure and infection. And so doxorubicin was introduced in the early 70s and has generally been considered to be the most active chemotherapeutic agent in treatment of breast cancer. In particular, in patients with advanced breast cancer who have received previous chemotherapy, doxorubicin monotherapy has produced a response rate of 25 to 33% at doses ranging from 60 to 75 milligrams per meter squared, that's body surface area. Now, the shocking thing about this is if you go instead to the cancer page put up by .gov, it says that five-year cure rates are 22%. So if you use doxorubicin over a five-year rate, you're going to have a survival of 25 to 33%. So you take this gain of between 2% and 11% over a five-year period, more or less, 1% of women per year might be alive. Well, that's a pretty minuscule benefit when you think that every day of those 5 years is filled with the agony of taking doxorubicin, which is Adriamycin, same thing, or living with the long-term side effects. So if you have a 22% five-year survival, add doxorubicin, and it becomes 25 to 33%, it may be statistically significant, but it's not clinically significant to any particular patient, because you're only adding anywhere from 0.4 to 2% survival chance per year. I mean, you're getting better odds if you go to the casino. So you're increasing an already dismal survival by 14%. So chance of being alive in 5 years goes from 22 to at best 33, and you're asking a patient to puke, destroy their heart, lose their quality of life. Now, you say, doctor, you're talking about Herceptin. What's this got to do with doxorubicin? Because when you compare effectiveness between Herceptin and doxorubicin, it's similar. And you look at this pedigree of doxorubicin and you realize that it might be that people would survive better without it. Certainly they would have more days of better quality of life without it. So it's very interesting. And this study was done in 1999. And so it's so what we have here, a case of a drug that has risen at $80,000 a dose to about a $1 billion a year situation. So the question is, how did this happen? You know, how did such a drug with no proven benefit become such a blockbuster hit? Well, let's take a look. Before I do that, I just want to talk about what doctors, information doctors get. So doctors are getting bombarded with lots of information. And there's this place called Medscape. And so Medscape has this whole article, Retooling the War on Cancer. So the gist of the article is the war on cancer is being lost. And so how can you tell the war is being lost? Well, when the therapies are ineffective, of course. And so they're blaming the problem on the structure of the cancer research system. And I think it's not really important what one blames a problem on, but the point is it does seem to be a problem that the medical doctors, the medical industry is acknowledging. So they're acknowledging that the cancer drugs are not effective and no more effective than they were in 1970 simply because, one, same drugs are being used, and two, new drugs are simply being compared to the old drugs. There is no straight-up therapy of, okay, let's compare this cancer therapy to doing nothing. And so that does not, that one has never happened. So let's take a look at the key to everything, marketing. So marketing is very important. And the success of Herceptin has been so huge that many people have taken a look at it to just to understand how such a success could take place. And so what they've done is these people, this marketing company, Diaceutics.com is who they are, and so they took a look at Herceptin, how it grew and what made Herceptin so successful financially. And so what they're saying is that Herceptin was mismanaged and the company could have made an extra $1 billion if only they'd done the right thing. And what did they say they should do? They should have managed the operational use of the HER2 testing. In other words, they should have managed and controlled the test that's used, that's administered to women to determine if they actually need Herceptin. And so Herceptin is a huge blockbuster hit because they've tied a drug to a test. So, if you do this test and it says yes, then you need this drug. And so this is what they found. And so the New York Times even did a nice soft advertising piece in 07 saying cancer drug may not be given to many women who need it. And so they urge more testing. So 40% of women with early breast cancer might benefit from the drug. They're not getting it. When actually people with early stage breast cancer probably wouldn't benefit from any drug because the mortality, according to the .gov site, is 0% in 5 years. So if you have a condition with 0% mortality, why treat it? Now, global Herceptin sales were pretty flat for the first 7 years. And then something changed. Something changed. What they did is the more tests were created that would indicate Herceptin was necessary. So they quote Michael Press, a pathologist at University of Southern California, and he says, one-third of positive antibody tests could be false positives. One study found that when five pathologists looked at the same slide, they disagreed on the diagnosis in half the cases. What does this mean? This means if you have a lady who has breast cancer and gets an HER2 test, and it says that, yes, you need Herceptin, there's a 50% chance that she really didn't need Herceptin. And then Dr. Salmon of UCLA, he's really cute. What does he say? He's, by the way, credited with developing Herceptin, stated, a high-level task force is required to figure out how to reduce mistakes in testing for HER2. As a first step, he said, any negative tumor samples should be retested by independent pathologists to make sure they're true negatives. And so since we know half of the positives are false positives, then we take a group of negative people and test them again, we're going to get some positives out of the group just because the test is unreliable. And so his solution to overuse of Herceptin is to test more people and get more positives. And this is the kind of reasoning that gets a lot of drugs that are not very effective given to a lot of women who don't benefit a whole lot. So people can start calling in with their questions. I'll be taking questions in about 5 minutes. And so this gets even more interesting. So then they did a study, and they polled the doctors to find out why ladies did not get Herceptin. And so what was the problem? And so they asked the doctors, what problems are you having giving your patients Herceptin? 20% of doctors said, well, the lab results are unreliable. 47% said, well, there aren't enough labs to send the test to, 47%. 53% said, well, I can't communicate with the lab and get the lab result back. And 50% said, can't get the insurance company to pay for it. So the accuracy of the test was a concern in 20% of doctors. So even if you solve that problem, you really wouldn't improve sales. But limited testing capacity, so increase the testing capacity. Get rid of that problem, you're going to double sales. Communication with the lab, solve that problem, because it's a 50% problem. Solve it, you double sales. And reimbursement, get those insurance companies to pay for it. You solve, it's another 50% problem, and you double sales. So 2, 4, 8, literally you can get an 8-fold increase potentially in sales by solving the insurance company reimbursement problem, communications with the lab problem the doctors are having, and the increased availability of testing. So what did they do? Finally, oh, this is called personalized medicine, by the way. When you can give a test to someone and say, oh, if this test is positive and you get this drug, that's a personalized medicine, even though, as we'll see, there's a lot of manipulation going on here. So there's three different tests. There's the FISH test, the FISH test, and the IHAC test. The important thing to understand is there's one test. One test is objective. One test is objective. Another one is objective. And the third one is only subjective. The person's kind of guess, is this positive or is this negative? Whereas the other tests have an internal control. That means the doctor or the pathologist sees something on the slide that looks a certain way. And if the slide, if he finds something in the slide that looks just like the sample they give him, then it's a positive. And there's another test that has no sample, whatever, and says the doctor, well, just tell me what you think. What's the gestalt? What's your feeling? And that is the test that 100% of cancer specialists adopted in 2008. The more objective tests fell out of favor, were not used, and so this test that was totally subjective, had no internal way of determining whether it was accurate, required no training, and had a low overall cost, was the one that's dominantly used, the IHC test. And so then what happened was guidelines were developed for HR2 testing, very complex, but basically it makes sure that the person gets tested frequently so that anytime they get a positive, they can get shunted right into the Herceptin treatment group. And so what happened then, they have an algorithm so that if any test outcome is uncertain, then boom, a further test is required. And then this makes sure the maximum number of people are qualified or deemed appropriate for Herceptin. And so they even looked at doctors' inclination to recommend Herceptin. And so what they found, if a lady had early cancer, the doctors were between 21% all the way up to 37% likely to prescribe it. But if she had advanced cancer, they were as high as 71% likely to prescribe it. But lately, that's been falling off. Now, the other thing that really happened was that the makers of Herceptin finally adopted a new model. They finally understood that the revenue flowed from the key role played by adopting the test. If the doctors, they could just get the doctors to do the test, then they would sell even more drug. And the problem, of course, was Genentech, the owner of the drug, did not own the laboratory service which produced the test results so they could have the control needed to produce the maximum number of positive results. And so what happened, as you can tell, is they decided to purchase a diagnostic company. And then this developed or produced the needed test results to fuel the growth. And so the moral of the story is a drug company with a prescription asset which is dependent upon a test should take a proactive approach to manage the diagnostic environment to drive adoption and use of the test and avoid implementation flaws from the outset. So Herceptin has actually become a medical marketing model. And so no place in here have we talked about increasing the effectiveness of the drug or even eliminating the women who have false positive tests. They paid lip service to it, but the answer, of course, was to test even more women to give even more tests to them. So What we have here is a serious blockbuster drug based on the drug's ability to modify X-ray findings, the drug's ability to increase quality or length of life. So this is really just absolutely shocking. And again, if you can do these Herceptin tests, especially if you can get Herceptin tests positive in women with early cancer, a cancer that has a 100% five-year survival, then so much the better, because that's the population you really want to give the drug to, and that's what we're taught in medical school. The person who's going to do the best is the person who never needed the therapy in the first place. And so that's what you always want to have your eyes out for, is you want to convince people who would do perfectly fine without the therapy to go ahead and take the therapy anyway, and that way it's going to seriously increase your survival numbers. And so this is a strategy that's actually taught in medical school. So what can you do naturally? Okay, this is not medical advice. Everyone's got to do what they think is the right thing. Just say no to drugs. This is definitely one to pass on. One thing you really need to do is you need to know what your survival is. Definitely know your numbers. You know, ask, you know, if you're interested, ask your doctor what your stage is. Then go online. It's online now. You can actually go online and find out what the survival rate is for your stage of cancer. And so if you have a stage of cancer that has a 100% survival rate, then why take a drug that's going to make you puke, give you heart failure, and destroy your quality of life? Well, it doesn't make any sense. Because if you already have a 100% survival rate, then you've got nothing to gain by taking the drug. That's really, that's number one. So know what you have to lose. And so if you're looking at 100% survival, then you've got a lot to lose by signing up for drug therapy of any kind. So that's important. Next thing to take a look at is, if you decide you want to go for it, what's your outcome? Why are you really taking the drug? Are you taking it because you want to increase to live longer? Well, then ask the question, how long are you going to live? How much longer will you live? And so if the answer is you're not going to live any longer, then that's not an objective that can be accomplished. The next thing is your quality of life. Are you going to live better? Are you going to throw up less? Are you going to have thicker, longer hair? Is it going to improve your sex life? Are you going to be able to do any of the or more of the things that you enjoy doing? So those are the things to ask yourself. And, you know, I have to remind you about the Popeye comic strip where there is a person who always said, I want a hamburger today, and I'll pay you gladly pay you Tuesday. Well, don't let your cancer person say, I'm going to make you miserable and awfully sick today, and then you'll have a better life in the future. That's really nonsense. I mean, if you wouldn't lend someone money for hamburger today and they're going to repay you Tuesday, then why would you allow someone to destroy your quality of life today in exchange for a better life in the future? I think it makes more sense to go to church and do something today for a better life in the hereafter, so to speak. So you have to really look at your outcome. Now, there are some reasons to take chemotherapy, because I've asked people have said to me, you know, Dr. Danis, I'm going to take chemotherapy. I don't think it's going to help me. It's totally useless, but I got to take it because my wife is a nurse, and if I don't take chemotherapy, then she's going to be really upset with me, and that's going to destroy our relationship. And I think that if I take enough vitamins, I'll survive chemotherapy. That's a reason to take chemotherapy. Hold your mirrors together. Another reason to take chemotherapy is a lot of people want to do the right thing. They want to please their doctor. They don't want their doctor to be upset with them. Okay? That's okay, fine. But realize that's what you're doing. You're pleasing your doctor. You know, you're adding to his economic plan. You're adding to his retirement. And that's okay. That's a decision. So what I'm trying to say is make sure that you're clear about why you're taking the chemotherapy. If you're taking the chemotherapy because you want to live longer, if you're taking the chemotherapy because you want to have a better quality of life, chances are very good that you'll be quite disappointed. So that's not the thing to do. What would I recommend doing? Well, I'll just tell you what I would do if I even thought I had cancer. If I thought I had cancer, I would definitely increase my bowel movements. I would poop more often. By the way, Vitality Capsules are going to be in stock this Friday. That's April 24th, 25th. I'm so thrilled. So that's what I would do. I would take more Vitality Capsules. The next thing I'd do is I would change my diet. I would go on first I would start with a vegan diet, and then what I would do is I would transition over to a diet with some meat, I guess the word would be animal products to rebuild my cells, and I would make sure they were clean as in never immunized, no antibiotics, no pesticides, and natural feed. You know, I would even go so far as to live someplace where if I was going to eat an animal, it literally grew up in my backyard. So you got to clean up your food. You got to clean up your diet. And for many people, this is tough because many people now, their diet is the new designer clothing. They actually derive their social status from their diet and from the expensive foods that they're able to buy. And so what you need to do is divorce the foods at that expense from your practice. So in other words, realize that food is for nutrition, food is for health, and it's not for a display of your social status. You have to do that, find some other way to express your social status. Because the problem is the social status or social value of a food is determined more by its marketing, not really by its health content. So, I'm looking at at the chat room. I'm not sure if the chat room has any questions here.
Q-U-E-S-T-I-O-N.
So that's what I would do. And then nutrition-wise, if you have cancer, you definitely you're malnourished. Don't even worry about it. You are seriously malnourished, and you can just count on that. And so since you're malnourished, yes, definitely take supplements. One cancer, which is pancreatic cancer. When I went to medical school, they said, pancreatic cancer, don't worry, you're going to drop dead. 6 months, you'll be dead for sure. Don't worry about it. And so what some ignorant patients did, ignorant lay people, they said, you know what, that sounds stupid. I'll bet if I took some vitamins, it would help. And sure enough, these uneducated people took a fistful of vitamins, and now everyday people have managed to extend their pancreatic cancer survival from anywhere from 2 to 10 years just by taking vitamins and modifying their diet. So that's a huge, huge effect in that particular very dismal cancer that people just took into their own hands. All right. My chat room says they hate the term lay people. I'm here to tell you I use that term because so many people tell me that they lack confidence in their abilities, and I think they should have confidence in their abilities. And to say that they're not a doctor should give them confidence because they haven't been brainwashed, and they actually have a greater chance of improving their outcomes. Okay, so that's the end of our show today, and we will see you again next week on Healing with Dr. Daniels. Thank you.
Thanks.